little group tonight. I'll say hi to Cinda, even though I can't see her, but I imagine she's there. And Coral. And Sam. Joan. Susan. Bob. Paul. Mark in Australia. Franklin. Marv. Mark and Aloha. Drew. Jim. And Ruth Ann. All right. So let's see. Term student opening retreat this Saturday. In-person picnic coming up the following Saturday, the 19th. At what did we decide? Like 2 p.m., 3 p.m.? Anybody remember? 2? Okay. 2 to 4. You know, you don't have to stay the whole time. Where we had Jukai in Cedar Hills Park. And we'll be socially distanced and bring your own food and stuff. I think that's it. The 19th will also be a book group day. So I guess that's it. So tonight, we're continuing with Uchiyama Roshi's book, How to Cook Your Life. Chapter 11, Living Through the Life of the Self. So he focuses on the part of the Tenzo Kyokun, the instructions to the cook, where he talks to the two different Tenzos that he meets in China. And they both give him a similar kind of lesson. So this starts on page 9. And he talks about, when I was at Mount Tiantong, a monk called Lu from Qingyuan Fu was serving as Tenzo. One day after the noon meal, I was walking to another building within the complex when I noticed Lu drying mushrooms in the sun in front of the Butsudan. He carried a bamboo stick but had no hat on his head. The sun's rays beat down so harshly that the tiles along the walk burned one's feet. Lu worked hard and was covered with sweat. I could not help but feel the work was too much of a strain for him. His back was a bow drawn tight. His long eyebrows were crane white. I approached and asked his age. He replied that he was 68 years old. Then I went on to ask him why he never used any assistants. He answered, "Other people are not me." "You are right," I said. "I can see your work is the activity of the Buddha Dharma, but why are you working so hard in this scorching sun?" He replied, "If I do not do it now, when else can I do it?" So he also talks about the story of the other Tenzo that he meets, who had walked 14 miles to buy mushrooms or some ingredient from the ship that Dogen was on. And Dogen struck up a conversation with him and wanted to talk with him some more. But then the monk said, "I gotta go, because I gotta hike 14 miles back to the monastery, and otherwise nobody will be there to cook the meals." And so it was a similar message of taking responsibility for the job. And then the message that Uchiyama takes out of this for the chapter is, you know, there's many things you could take out of those stories, but what he takes out of it is a sense of living one's own life fully, not looking to anyone else or any other circumstances to make it different or better, kind of fully inhabiting one's life. So in this case, the Tenzos were fully, they, this was their role. Yes, it was hot. Yes, they had to walk a long way. Yes, they had a lot of work to do, but this was their life. This was the stuff of their life. So he then talks about, kind of compares it to a story of a man suffering in the hospital, nearly blind, half paralyzed, possibly facing death. And he says that this man, whenever he thought about death, he became dreadfully afraid. He no longer had any hope or joy in life and was completely bewildered as to how to cope with his situation. And surprisingly, you kind of expect that kind of story, right? This is a Zen teacher. This is a priest saying, you know, this guy wrote to him saying that he didn't know how to cope and he was sad and depressed. And Uchiyama says, I don't have anything to say to this guy. There's nothing I can do for him. And I think that's a very interesting approach because he basically says like that he said, perhaps some other kind of religion would have something they could offer him. Oh, you're going to go to heaven, or if you pray, the pain will go away, or some kind of promise. But then he says, once that promise turned out to not be fulfilled, then the guy might be even more in even more despair. So his message basically is that the Buddhism doesn't have anything to offer that's going to make the pain magically disappear. That this is, life has these kinds of things in it. So what can we do? So he says, reminding ourselves, you cannot exchange so much as a fart with anyone else. No matter what circumstances we fall into, we have no real choice but to live through it by ourselves. So then he tells the story of being out begging, the typical monastic rounds, where they go through the streets in Takahatsu and beg for usually money with which to buy food for the monastery or for themselves. And he talks about cutting his toe a little bit, but it wasn't a big deal. And he just bound it up when he got back to the monastery. But then he went out begging again another day and it got wet and then it ends up getting infected. And he sounds like he ends up with like sepsis. I mean, he's just completely deadly ill, in extreme pain, can hardly move the side that, you know, he has this injury on. But he can't afford a doctor, so he just suffers through it, saying he's in such extreme pain that he doesn't sleep for 3 days. And some neighbor comes over with a little licorice bulb and says, you know, if he grinds it up and puts it on the toe, that it'll help. So that's all the help he got. But then he has a very interesting kind of conclusion, lesson that he draws out of this. And he says, I realized when I stopped fighting the pain and just let it be inside me, the burden of the suffering would be lifted. And I want to read his poem that he wrote, called Suffering a Foot Injury. If I had a wife to care for me, if my parents were near, if I had money, I wouldn't have suffered. In my dust-covered room, laying on ragged quilts, recalling Job, I can bear this hard pain. I am grateful. People worry, what if I lose my savings? What if I become ill, lose my job? Always framing their thoughts, what if? They're afraid, though their fears are groundless. Though I'm ill, without savings or income, unable to eat, even if I starved, I wouldn't think it strange. And just for that, I'm grateful. So I guess in a sense, you could, another way that you could describe this is calling it acceptance. Acceptance of your experience or your situation. But as I use that term, I'll give a reminder that Buddhist acceptance means letting go of resistance to things having turned out this way. It's letting go of resistance to the past, because there's nothing whatsoever we can do about it. Here we are. Just or unjust, whether it makes sense or not, whether we're to blame or someone else is to blame, here we are. So acceptance of that, letting go of resistance to that because it's futile, but it has nothing to do with resignation about the future. It has nothing to do with the future in a way. We may need to do something, we may need to respond, whatever. So this acceptance is really about the here and now and kind of what has led us to here. So there's different levels and aspects to this kind of acceptance. So I wanted to share my screen and just do a little brainstorm of you can see the blank document, right? All right. If you were laying in bed in extreme pain, like Uchiyama Roshi, who couldn't even sleep for 3 days, what would you do in order to practice the way he describes? You know, aspiring to accept what is happening, or he's also said to live through it by yourself, or to stop fighting the pain. So what might you do? What might you tell yourself? What might you think about? What kind of approach might you take in order to practice this kind of acceptance, just being with it?
So I think part of the point is not to try to run away or escape from the experience, but so I guess I would try to be really inquisitive about what I was going through. So like, what's the nature of the pain? Like, where do I feel it? How do I feel it? How frequently does it come? You know, like all the details about it. And essentially try to, you know, again, back to like the acceptance part, it's like you have to understand it in order to accept it. You can't push it away.
One of the things I've really been leaning into the last 6 months. Well, I haven't been studying Buddhism for 6 months, so since May, but once I learned it is the second arrow. The first arrow is always going to hurt. You can't stop that one, but the second arrow you fully control, and that's how you respond, react, how you deal with the pain. And that's been a major part of my practice for weeks, months now, is how to avoid the second arrow. You know, whether it's breathing through it, you know, just working to, you know, the control, the understanding of controlling my own suffering. Yeah, I have pain. It's part of my daily life. It's my life koan right now, and it's something I practice with, but my focus has been on breaking the pain cycle and stopping the, you know, my reaction, my suffering, my fear, my sadness, all of these other things that are part of the second arrow.
And in case anybody's not familiar, that's a classic Buddhist teaching that says when we suffer, it's like we've been hit by an arrow and then we stab ourselves with a second arrow. We're like, oh no, look, I've been hurt. Oh.
Yeah, I'm trying to do my best to not keep stabbing myself in the head with multitude of arrows.
Yeah. Ruthann, did you have something?
Oh, yes. I do imagery. You know, as Sam said, breathe in to the pain. And then, as I said, I do imagery, some color therapy. And I think even though we might be prone and uncomfortable, I think I would try a bit of Sazen, even if it were in short bursts, just kind of up on the screen for myself, play games, thinking that, well, when it gets a bit better, I could do this, or I could probably move this muscle as it eases, maybe, kind of thing.
Huh. I like that. Be kind of playful with it. It occurs to me as we're making this list that it is very, it's kind of straightforward to imagine being in a lot of physical pain and then what do we do about it? But I'm thinking about how all these things also apply for like mental and emotional pain and stress, and we might not be as obviously inclined to deal with it in the same way.
I think part of the point of the second arrow teaching is that the real suffering is always mental. Mm-hmm. And maybe because of that and following on from that, I like to use the Madhupindika, the Honeyball Sutta, which in very brief form asks you to examine the difference between what is actually happening and what is the story you're telling about it? Because it's the story, the fear that it will get worse, the fear that it'll never end, the fear that you'll die. That's what causes the mental suffering.
Nice.
Yeah, can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. So I was thinking before about emotional pain, because it is different. And I remember one time when I was in a lot of emotional pain due to grief.
Uh-huh.
So I didn't back away, which is something different for me. And in the end, I was very happy that I did that, because maybe that's just feeling the pain, I guess, and accepting it. And then you get through it. Just feeling it, and it was,
mm-hmm.
It seemed like a good thing in retrospect. It surprised me, but.
Yeah, I mean, our kind of ingrown natural inclination is try to make pain stop and try to get away from the pain, and Nice.
Can I add another scripture?
Sure.
Sorry, the Anathapindika Sutta. This is the story of Anathapindika, the patron of the Buddha at Sravasti. When he was dying, he was in terrible pain. And the Buddha did not go to see him, but several of the disciples went and they preached to him the sutta, which they claimed had been withheld from lay people. It was only for monks until right now they were going to let Anathapindika hear it, and that would be its opening to lay people. And basically the teaching is to not attach to your sensations.
And then in the sutta, Anathapindika achieves full awakening upon hearing the sutta, right?
Oh, I don't remember.
I believe he does. He says, "Oh, finally! Why did you guys tell me that before?"
He cries a lot.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to mention that this idea of acceptance is it's pretty cool that it's sort of found its way into mainstream psychology, and that there's actually a therapy, which I see a therapist that does this, called acceptance commitment therapy. And it's really based, it's a cognitive-based therapy, I guess. It's what, specifically, I don't know how it's related to cognitive-based therapy. But what's interesting about it is, you know, we spend, in psychology, there's always been this kind of notion of transformation and ways to sort of, I guess when you think about pain, we've very fixated on escaping it. Whereas in acceptance commitment therapy, the idea is to accept the reality of your emotional state, but not get sort of swallowed up by it, right? And so it's like, okay, so you feel, let's say you're traumatized from something that happened at birth or you know, in your childhood, and the natural inclination, and maybe the way this has worked, been discussed in the past, has been, oh, you got to work through that trauma, you know, get through it, da-da-da. And what they would say in acceptance commitment therapy is you'll never get through that trauma, but you will learn how to sort of lessen its impact on you and work through it in that way. So it's very, what I like about it is it's very close to what a lot of Buddhism is talking about. And so I just thought it was really interesting that Buddhism and psychology do tend to go hand in hand. I guess there is such a thing as Buddhist psychology, but it's the stuff is actually practiced out there in the real world too.
Yeah.
So that's all.
Thanks. That's great. So, you know, I had, right, I had jotted down some possibilities, noticing the narrative, noticing when we're saying why me, and recognizing how that's not very helpful, but also, like, you know, in the spirit of Zazen, not trying to get rid of that, just recognizing that. I mean, just the truth is enough. Just seeing the truth is enough. Staying in the body, expanding just this to include our feelings and reactions and stress and anxiety and fear. So I was thinking of there as being different levels, different aspects to this acceptance, being in the mind, letting go of narratives and explanations, trying to practice mindfulness, cultivating awareness of the here and now. And again, not so much as a corrective thing, like, oh no, now I'm thinking about that again, discipline my mind to come back to the present, but more of that way that we do in Zazen, with just an open-handed, like, recognizing once there I am thinking, you know, catastrophizing again. That is just a story. I don't want to do that. want to just be here and now. So it's kind of a, you know, this is what we want to do. And then with the heart, that embracing our current experience, including our reactions, compassion for self and other. And then there's a physical aspect to this living through what we're experiencing, kind of a moment by moment embodied experience in terms of not fighting the pain. It's not, it's, you know, at a certain point, even when the stories are let go, there is that moment to moment experience we have to stay with. So I wanted to suggest we do a guided meditation. So I invite you to close your eyes if you like, or just make yourself comfortable and just get centered in your breathing and in your body, whatever posture you're in. Just be aware of your posture. Feel the chair or the floor or whatever it is that you're sitting on. Be aware of any sounds in your environment. Just let them be a connection to the present. And then expand your awareness and aim to relax completely. Imagine that you are a Buddha and you have an expansive and confident sense of reality. Just a confidence that everything is just as it should be. You're centered and strong, upright, deeply satisfied. Grateful. Feeling very safe, alive, and attentive. Imagine how you would feel if everything was all right and at peace. Your body was okay and at peace, healthy, comfortable. If your mind was at peace, your worries and stresses relieved, problems solved, if your practice was at peace, as practice you felt was as vital, exactly as it should be, if your life, including your family, your work, your responsibilities, all at a place where everything is okay and at ease, taken care of. Imagine the country was at peace. Imagine we had found out a way to talk to one another and live together peacefully. That we'd made great strides in justice and democracy and sustainable living. And the whole world was similarly at peace. You knew everything was okay and you could relax and just be. So now become aware of areas of tension or resistance that exist within you. Maybe some sadness, some fear, pain, worry, confusion, anger, stress, concern for things within your life or in the world around you. Things that aren't all right. Things that aren't at peace. Let the associated images and people and situations and experiences arise in your mind and heart. Things for which you feel compassion, concern. And let these things and your responses to them just be present in your meditation. Hold them gently within your mind and body and heart without trying to fix them or figure them out. Embrace the points of stress and tension or resistance as part of your experience. Just like your breath. The sounds you hear. The light in the room. The temperature of the air on your skin. And I'll end with the last two lines of Uchiyama Roshi's poem. Though I'm ill, without savings or income, unable to eat, even if starved, I wouldn't think it strange. And just for that, I'm grateful. So, I want to go into a couple breakout rooms, to talk about the last two lines of that poem and what on earth do they mean. Though I'm ill, without savings or income, unable to eat, even if I starved, I wouldn't think it strange. And just for that, I'm grateful. So let's see. Here we go. Any interesting things come up in the rooms that people want to make note of? So I think I think it's really valuable and important to note that Uchiyama admits, even though he talks about having had this near-death experience and he writes this poem about, you know, that he reached this place of feeling so okay about it, that the suffering was gone. The second arrow was removed. But he admits that should he end up in a similar situation someday, he'd have to do that work all over again. You know, that in a sense that previous wisdom would not inoculate him against the suffering. That it would be that moment's practice then to be present and simply be with. So, really liked this passage toward the end, where he sums it up saying, "These passages, other people are not me. And if I do not do it now, when shall I do it? Reflect an undeniable truth. The degree of separation from the reality of life appears as suffering and struggling. What we should be truly grateful for is that no matter how much we suffer and agonize, it is only suffering and agony going on in our minds. And when we die, this mind too passes away." So the degree of separation from the reality of life appears as suffering and struggling. Any other thoughts? All right. Thank you all for being here. I will, I don't have my bell. I'll have to get in the habit of bringing my bell up here to the desktop computer, but we offer the merit of this Dharma study together to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all.
Thank you. Stay safe, everyone.
All right. You too.
Yeah. Hey, sweet dreams.